A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about a genuine pharmacological paradox. If the brain fights tooth and nail to restore its chemical balance, how do drugs like SSRIs and Vyvanse keep working for years without losing their punch? This isn't about tolerance or addiction. It's about the fundamental neuroscience of what happens when you push against homeostasis for a decade, and the brain doesn't push back the way you'd expect. There's a lot to unpack here.
The paradox is sharper than most people realize. The brain's homeostatic machinery is formidable. You've got receptor desensitization through phosphorylation and internalization, downregulation of receptor synthesis at the gene level, upregulation of reuptake transporters, entire intracellular signaling cascades that recalibrate. In theory, all of this should gradually neutralize any drug you take chronically, and for many drugs, that's exactly what happens.
Benzodiazepines being the poster child for this.
Take a benzodiazepine daily for anxiety, and within 1 to 2 weeks, the sedative effects are meaningfully diminished. GABA. A receptor's internalize, subunit composition shifts, and you need higher doses to get the same effect. That's classical tolerance. Opioids do the same thing at mu-opioid receptors. The receptor literally gets phosphorylated, beta-arrestin gets recruited, the whole complex gets pulled into the cell and either recycled or degraded. The drug becomes less effective because the target is physically disappearing.
The question becomes, what are SSRIs and Vyvanse doing that benzos and opioids aren't?
That's where things get genuinely elegant. Let's start with SSRIs because the answer here is almost philosophically interesting. The common understanding is that SSRIs work by increasing serotonin. Block the serotonin transporter. More serotonin hangs around in the synapse, mood improves. Except, that's not actually how they work.
This is the misconception that needs to die.
It really does. When you take an SSRI, serotonin levels in the synapse do increase within hours. But nobody feels better in hours. The clinical effect takes 2 to 4 weeks minimum, sometimes 6 to 8. So the acute increase in serotonin cannot be the therapeutic mechanism. Something downstream has to happen.
That something is the brain adapting.
Here's the mechanism. In the Raf nuclei, that's the brainstem cluster where most serotonin neurons originate, there are these inhibitory autoreceptors called 5-HT1A receptors. They sit on the serotonin neurons themselves and act as a brake. When synaptic serotonin rises, these autoreceptors detect it and tell the neuron to fire less. It's a negative feedback loop. So when you first take an SSRI and serotonin starts accumulating, the 5-HT1A autoreceptors slam the brakes. Serotonin neuron firing actually decreases. That's why you don't feel better immediately. You're fighting your own feedback inhibition.
The brain is actively resisting the drug at this stage.
But here's the key. If you keep taking the SSRI, those 5-HT1A autoreceptors themselves begin to desensitize and downregulate. Over the course of 2 to 4 weeks, they stop responding so vigorously. The brake loosens. Serotonin neurons resume firing at normal or even elevated rates. And now, critically, the serotonin that's being released stays in the synapse longer because the transporter is still blocked. You get a net increase in serotonergic signaling. And this timing matches clinical onset almost perfectly.
We know this from actual human imaging, not just animal models.
PET imaging studies using a radioligand called carbon-11 WEI10635, which binds to 5-HT1A receptors, have shown exactly this desensitization in human subjects treated with SSRIs. You can literally watch the autoreceptors become less responsive over the same time course the depression scores start to improve. It's one of the cleaner causal chains in psychopharmacology.
The homeostatic adaptation is the treatment. The brain fights the drug, and the fight itself is what heals.
That's the central insight. And it's why SSRIs don't produce classical tolerance. The drug isn't doing the work directly, it's creating conditions under which the brain's own adaptive machinery produces a new steady state. Once those autoreceptors have desensitized and downstream changes kick in, things like BDNF signaling, hippocampal neurogenesis, synaptic plasticity in cortical circuits, you've essentially retuned the system. The brain is now maintaining a different equilibrium, and the SSRI is just there to keep the transporter blocked so the new equilibrium holds.
Those downstream changes, the BDNEF, the neurogenesis, those take even longer to develop, which might explain why full remission often takes months, not weeks.
And it also explains something clinicians see all the time. If you discontinue an SSRI abruptly, you don't just snap back to baseline in a day. The relapse of depression, when it happens, often takes weeks or months, because all those downstream structural changes need time to revert. The brain has physically remodeled itself in response to the drug, and that remodeling doesn't undo overnight.
That's the SSRI case. The brain's homeostatic response is the mechanism. But Vyvanse works through a completely different logic. It's not about turning adaptation into treatment. It's about designing a drug that the brain barely notices it needs to adapt to.
This is where pharmacokinetics becomes everything. Vyvanse is lisdexamfetamine. It's a prodrug. The molecule itself is inactive. It consists of D-amphetamine bound to the amino acid lysine. You swallow it, it gets absorbed, and then enzymes in your red blood cells cleave off that lysine, gradually releasing active D-amphetamine into the bloodstream. This is not a slow-release formulation where the pill physically dissolves over time. This is a rate-limited enzymatic conversion happening in your circulation.
Which means you can't snort it, you can't inject it, and, critically for our discussion, you can't produce a rapid spike in brain dopamine.
The time to peak plasma concentration for Vyvanse is about 3.5 hours. Compare that to immediate-release amphetamine, which peaks in 1 to 2 hours. Compare it to cocaine, which peaks in minutes. The speed of onset turns out to be one of the most important variables in whether the brain mounts a homeostatic counter-response.
Why does the speed matter so much?
Because the brain's homeostatic sensors appear to be tuned to rate of change, not just absolute levels. A slow, gradual rise in dopamine over 3 to 4 hours doesn't trigger the same alarm bells as a sharp spike. Think of it like a thermostat. If the temperature creeps up 0.5 degree an hour, the system barely responds. If it jumps 5 degrees in 5 minutes, the air conditioning kicks on full blast. The brain's compensatory mechanisms, receptor phosphorylation, internalization, changes in transporter expression, they seem to be triggered by the slope of the concentration curve, not just its height.
Vyvanse is basically sneaking past the brain's homeostatic security system.
In a sense, yes, but there's more to it. D-amphetamine doesn't just block the dopamine transporter like methylphenidate does, it's a substrate for DAT and also for VMAT2, the vesicular monoamine transporter. It enters the presynaptic neuron through DAT, then gets into synaptic vesicles through VMAT2, and it displaces dopamine from those vesicles into the cytoplasm. The cytoplasmic dopamine concentration rises, and then DAT actually reverses direction. It pumps dopamine out into the synapse instead of clearing it. This is fundamentally different pharmacology from simple reuptake inhibition.
This reversal mechanism, does the brain have a way to compensate for it specifically?
That's a fascinating question, and the answer seems to be region-dependent. In the striatum, which is rich in dopamine terminals and heavily involved in reward and motor function, chronic amphetamine treatment does produce compensatory changes. DAT expression actually increases in some striatal subregions, which would tend to clear dopamine faster and reduce the drug's effect. This is part of why recreational amphetamine users develop tolerance to the euphoric effects.
The therapeutic effect for IDHD isn't primarily striatal.
The cognitive benefits, improved attention, working memory, executive function, are mediated largely through prefrontal cortex. And in the prefrontal cortex, the homeostatic response looks different. DAT density is much lower there to begin with. Dopamine clearance in the prefrontal cortex relies more on COM, the catechol-O-methyltransferase enzyme, and on norepinephrine transporters, so the compensatory machinery that kicks in for striatal dopamine doesn't apply in the same way. The prefrontal cortex seems to maintain responsiveness to the drug's cognitive effects, even as striatal responses diminish.
Which might explain the clinical observation that people on stable Vyvanse doses don't get a euphoric kick after the first few weeks, but the focus and executive function benefits persist.
That's precisely the pattern. The motivational or activating effects tend to attenuate somewhat because those are more striatal. The cognitive effects in the prefrontal cortex are much more durable. And there's another layer here that I find really compelling. It's about tonic versus phasic dopamine signaling.
Break that down.
Dopamine neurons can fire in two modes. Tonic firing is a steady, low-frequency background activity that maintains a baseline level of extracellular dopamine. Phasic firing is a burst of high-frequency activity in response to salient stimuli, something unexpected, something rewarding, something threatening. The brain processes these two modes very differently. Tonic dopamine is thought to set the gain on how responsive the system is. Phasic dopamine is the actual signal.
Vyvanse affects both?
It elevates tonic dopamine by providing a sustained, low-level increase throughout the day. This may actually stabilize the system and improve the signal-to-noise ratio for phasic bursts, rather than overwhelming them. A rapid spike from immediate-release amphetamine can flood the system and trigger phasic-like responses to things that aren't meaningful, which the brain then compensates for. The slow, steady elevation from Vyvanse operates more like turning up the contrast on a display. It makes real signals easier to detect without generating noise.
It's not just that the brain doesn't notice Vyvanse. It's that the drug is working in a mode the brain already uses for its own regulation.
That's a beautiful way to put it. And it connects to something that often gets overlooked in these discussions, the role of circadian and behavioral entrainment. Most people take their ADHD medication on a predictable schedule, once a day, in the morning. The brain's dopamine system already has a circadian rhythm. Dopamine levels naturally rise during the active phase of the day and fall during sleep. By taking Vyvanse at the same time every morning, you're essentially aligning the drug's pharmacokinetic profile with the brain's existing dopaminergic rhythm. The brain may process this as a predictable daily signal rather than a constant perturbation.
Like adopting a feral cat.
I'm not sure that analogy holds, but I appreciate the attempt.
No, think about it. If you try to grab a feral cat, it fights you. If you put food out at the same time every day and sit quietly nearby, eventually the cat incorporates you into its routine and stops seeing you as a threat. The brain's homeostatic machinery is the feral cat. Vyvanse is the bowl of food at 6 a.m.
Actually, not terrible. The predictability matters, and this has implications for something clinicians debate constantly, drug holidays. The idea that you should skip Vyvanse on weekends to prevent tolerance.
Which, if this model is right, would be counterproductive.
If the brain has adapted to the drug as part of a predictable daily cycle, then intermittent dosing disrupts that predictability. You're essentially telling the brain every weekend, never mind, the cat isn't coming today, and then on Monday, surprise, here's the cat again. That intermittent pattern might be more likely to trigger compensatory responses than a consistent daily routine.
There's also the practical issue that ADHD doesn't take weekends off. People still need to drive safely, manage relationships, handle household tasks. The idea that medication is only for school or work has always struck me as a narrow framing.
It's not just the cognitive effects. There's emerging evidence that consistent treatment may actually promote more normal neurodevelopment in children and adolescents with ADHD. The brain adapts to the medication in ways that may be structurally beneficial over the long term. But we're getting into a broader discussion. Let me pull us back to the core question. We now have two very different solutions to the same problem. SSRIs work because the homeostatic adaptation is the treatment itself. Vyvanse works because its pharmacokinetic design minimizes the trigger for homeostatic compensation. Is there a common principle here?
The common principle seems to be that successful chronic medications don't fight the brain's plasticity. They work with it. They either harness the adaptive response or they root around the senses that trigger it.
That's a principle that extends well beyond psychiatry. It's showing up in how we think about drug design across the board. Allosteric modulators, for instance. Drugs that bind to sites on receptors other than the active site and modulate the receptor's response to its natural ligand rather than just jamming the receptor open or closed. That's a way of working with the existing signaling dynamics instead of overriding them.
or biased agonists, drugs that activate some signaling pathways downstream of a receptor, but not others. The idea is to get the therapeutic effect without triggering the pathways that lead to tolerance and side effects.
And you can see this logic in some of the newer antidepressants too. Ketamine and esketamine work through a completely different mechanism. NMDA receptor antagonism leading to rapid BDNF release and synaptic growth, and the acute effects last hours, but the antidepressant effect can last days or weeks. Again, the drug triggers a cascade of adaptive changes that outlast the drug itself. The brain does the heavy lifting.
We're moving from a model where the drug is the treatment to a model where the drug is the trigger, and the brain's plasticity is the treatment.
That reframing matters for how patients understand their own treatment. The chemical imbalance. Model. The idea that depression is just low serotonin and SSRIs just top it up has been rightly criticized for years. It's simplistic to the point of being misleading. But the alternative narrative that sometimes emerges, we don't actually know how these drugs work, is also wrong. We do know. They work by engaging the brain's adaptive machinery. The mechanism is understood in considerable detail. It's just more interesting than a simple filling a tank model.
It also matters for the discontinuation conversation. If SSRIs work by creating a new steady state that the brain maintains, then stopping the drug doesn't just remove a chemical crutch, it removes the condition that maintains the new equilibrium. The brain will eventually drift back toward its previous state. That's not addiction or withdrawal in the classical sense. It's the system reverting to an older attractor state.
The rate at which that happens depends on which mechanisms have been engaged. For SSRIs, if you've had months or years of enhanced BDNF signaling and hippocampal neurogenesis, those structural changes don't vanish in a week. But they do gradually reverse. For Vyvanse, the situation is different. The drug is maintaining a daily signal that aligns with circadian rhythms. Remove it, and the signal disappears within a day. The drug's half-life is short. But the cognitive benefits for ADHD aren't about structural remodeling in the same way. They're about state-dependent enhancement of prefrontal function. So discontinuation effects are more immediate, but also more reversible.
This distinction probably explains why SS or I discontinuation can be so prolonged and difficult. You're not just clearing a drug from your system. You're waiting for neuroanatomical remodeling to occur.
That remodeling can be uncomfortable. The brain doesn't smoothly transition between attractor states. There's often a period of instability, which is what SS or I discontinuation syndrome likely represents. Dizziness, brain zaps, mood swings. The system is literally recalibrating.
There's a clinical term that sounds like a rejected sci-fi concept.
The actual clinical term is sensory disturbances or paresthesia, but patients describe them as brief electrical shock sensations in the head, and the literature has basically adopted brain zaps as the colloquial term. They're real. They're common in SS or I discontinuation, and we don't fully understand the mechanism. One hypothesis is that they're related to rapid changes in serotonergic signaling in sensory pathways as autoreceptors and postsynaptic receptors readjust.
Even the withdrawal symptoms are evidence of the brain adapting. The whole story is adaptation, from start to finish.
That's the point that I think is most underappreciated. We tend to think of the brain as a passive recipient of drugs. You take a pill, the chemical does something to your neurons, you feel different. But that's never how it works. The brain is an active, predictive, homeostatic system. It's constantly adjusting its own parameters to maintain stability. When you introduce a drug, the brain doesn't just sit there and take it. And whether that reorganization is therapeutic or counterproductive depends on the specific drug, the specific mechanism, and the specific design choices that went into the molecule.
Which brings us to a provocative framing. The brain is not fighting the drug, it's learning from it.
That's a compelling way to put it, though I'd want to be careful about the word learning. It's not learning in the cognitive sense. But in terms of synaptic plasticity and homeostatic recalibration, the brain is certainly incorporating the drug's signal into its ongoing model of what the internal environment looks like. And when that signal is designed well, when it's predictable, when it works through naturalistic pathways, when it engages adaptive mechanisms rather than just brute-forcing receptor activation, the brain can maintain that new state almost indefinitely.
There's a humility in that framing that I think the pharmaceutical industry sometimes lacks. The best drugs aren't the ones that overpower the brain. They're the ones that persuade it.
Persuasion requires understanding the system you're trying to persuade. That's where the neuroscience matters. It's not enough to know that a receptor is involved in a disorder. You need to know how that receptor is regulated, what happens downstream, what compensatory mechanisms exist, what the time course of adaptation is, what the regional differences are. All of that feeds into whether a drug will work for 2 weeks or 2 decades.
Let's talk about an example from the other direction. A drug where this wasn't understood and the consequences were severe. I'm thinking of the early dopamine agonists used for Parkinson's disease. Direct activation of dopamine receptors, bypassing the degenerating neurons. They worked initially, but the brain's compensatory response, receptor downregulation, led to diminishing effects and sometimes severe side effects like impulse control disorders. The drug was fighting the brain, and the brain fought back.
That's a great example, and it's part of why L-DOPA, which is a metabolic precursor that the remaining neurons can still convert to dopamine, has remained a mainstay of treatment despite its own long-term complications. It works more through the brain's existing machinery rather than just hammering receptors directly. Though L-DOPA has its own complex long-term issues with dyskinesias, which is a whole separate discussion about pulsatile versus continuous dopamine stimulation.
Pulsatile versus continuous. That sounds a lot like our Vyvanse discussion. The importance of kinetics over raw pharmacology.
It's the same principle surfacing in a different disorder. The brain seems to handle continuous, stable signaling much better than intermittent spikes. This shows up in Parkinson's, in ADHD, in hormone replacement therapy, probably in many other domains. The pattern of receptor activation matters as much as the magnitude.
If we're looking forward, what does the next generation of psychotropics look like?
I think we'll see more prodrugs designed with specific kinetic profiles, like Vyvanse, but for different targets. More allosteric modulators that tune receptor sensitivity rather than turning receptors on or off. More drugs that target downstream signaling cascades, things like BDNF signaling, mTOR pathways, epigenetic regulators, rather than just neurotransmitter levels. The goal will be to engage the brain's plasticity machinery more directly and more precisely.
Hopefully, fewer drugs that were discovered by accident and whose mechanisms were reverse engineered decades later.
That's the history of psychopharmacology in a sentence. The first antidepressants were discovered because clinicians noticed that a tuberculosis drug, iproniazid, made patients inexplicably happy. It turned out to be a monoamine oxidase inhibitor. The first antipsychotic, chlorpromazine, was originally developed as an antihistamine for surgical patients. Someone noticed it made people calm and indifferent, and psychiatry ran with it. We've been playing catch-up with serendipity ever since.
The sloth approach to drug discovery. Wait long enough and something interesting happens.
I don't think that's a recognized methodology.
It should be. It's served my people well for millions of years.
Your people have one of the slowest metabolisms in the animal kingdom. I'm not sure that translates to pharmacological insight.
We're patient observers. We notice patterns, like the fact that nobody ever asks why a drug keeps working. They just take the pill and move on. But the question Daniel's asking, how does the brain maintain a new equilibrium for decades? That's the kind of question you only get to when you stop and think.
The answer turns out to be more interesting than most people expect. It's not that the drugs are more powerful than homeostasis. It's that the drugs have evolved, through a combination of accident and design, to work within the homeostatic framework rather than against it. SSRIs turn the brain's own negative feedback into a therapeutic mechanism. Vyvanse uses pharmacokinetic stealth to provide a stable signal that the brain incorporates into its daily rhythm. Both approaches acknowledge that the brain will adapt. The question is whether that adaptation serves the treatment or undermines it.
It's almost a philosophy of medicine. You don't defeat the body's regulatory systems. You partner with them.
That's harder to do than just finding a molecule that binds to a receptor. It requires understanding the system at multiple levels, molecular, cellular, circuit, behavioral. It requires thinking about time courses and regional specificity and the difference between acute and chronic effects. Most of the low-hanging fruit in pharmacology has been picked. The next generation of drugs will need to be smarter about engaging biology rather than overpowering it.
Which is a nice way of saying we're finally getting past the sledgehammer phase of psychopharmacology.
We're moving toward precision tools. but the principles are clear, and for anyone taking these medications long-term, I think there's something reassuring in understanding that the brain isn't a passive battleground. It's an active participant. The drug isn't doing something to you. You and the drug are engaged in a process of mutual adaptation, and when that process is designed well, it can be sustained for a very long time.
The short answer to the prompt is, SSRIs work because the brain's adaptation to the drug is the treatment. Vyvanse works because the drug's design avoids triggering the kind of adaptation that would neutralize it. Two different strategies, same outcome, sustained efficacy against the pull of homeostasis.
The longer answer is that we're just beginning to understand how to design drugs that work this way deliberately, rather than stumbling onto them. The next decade of psychopharmacology is going to be about exploiting these principles systematically.
Which leaves us with an open question. If the brain can maintain these drug-induced steady states for years, what determines whether a given patient can eventually discontinue successfully? Is there a point where the new equilibrium becomes self-sustaining without the drug? Or does the drug always need to be present to hold the system in that attractive state?
That's the frontier. Some patients do seem to achieve remission that persists after discontinuation, especially with SSRIs, where the structural changes may, in some cases, become self-reinforcing. But we can't predict who. Understanding the factors that determine whether a drug-induced state becomes permanent or remains drug-dependent is one of the major unsolved problems in psychiatry.
The brain learns. The question is whether it remembers.
That's a perfect place to leave it. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1970s, a Honduran clockmaker named Arturo Mendez proposed the thermal memory theory of chronometry, arguing that mechanical clocks kept accurate time not through escapements, but by storing ambient temperature fluctuations in brass alloys that expanded and contracted in predictable daily cycles. He built 17 clocks based on this principle, all of which stopped working within 6 hours, and published a monograph titled The Sun's Pendulum that was cited approvingly by exactly one Swiss journal before being retracted.
17 clocks, all dead within 6 hours, and he still published the monograph. That's commitment.
The Sun's Pendulum. I'd read it.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, visit myweirdprompts.com for more, and please leave us a review. It helps other curious minds find the show.
I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.